75% of Americans believe in UFOs. 30% of Americans believe UFOs are vehicles from other worlds. And 3% of Americans believe they have been abducted by aliens. That's over 8 million people. They're out there, aren't they?
Welcome to the UFO Files Show with your host, Jerry Pippin.
It was a wonderful trip over here. We took the helicopter. We had landed in Roswell. I announced to people when I landed that I'd come in peace. let me tell you, there are more 9 and 10 year old boys around the country when I meet them. They ask me, "Have you been to Roswell? And is it true what they say?" And I tell them, "If I told you, I'd have to kill you." So, and their eyes get all big, you know. So we're going to keep our secrets here.
Our next guest is one of my favorite people. He's been a police investigator. He's still working, and he's very interested in the UFO field. He has several exclusives that we can talk to him about, some of the things he's covered over the years, and he's got some new stuff working as well. I'd like to say hello to James E. Clarkson. How are you?
Doing fine, Jerry.
Good. It's good to have you on from the Pacific Northwest. And first of all, we're going to finish what we gave a little tease about last week with you, and that will be the story of your Roswell witness. But before we get to that, you're back with MUFON, right?
I certainly am. And I guess that's a pretty good story in itself.
Yes, that's the reason I started with it. Tell me about it a little bit. You left kind of disenchanted, but now you're back, and I think you seem fairly happy.
Well, I am, and I guess it's because I'm a little bit different, and I think MUFON's a lot different. And the reason I say that is that I spent the last year kind of wandering around trying to figure out what I should do. And I tried a few things, and I never quite felt at home. I think there's a lot of people out there, you know, looking for a direction to go in this field, but you've got to find the place that you're comfortable with. And I realized, bottom line, across the board, I want to investigate UFOs. There isn't anything else that really grabs me as much as that. And to divert my attention or energies any other way just doesn't work. So then I had to ask myself, okay, how am I going to go about that? Well, fortunately, the universe kind of answered my question, and I started working on cases for Bill Puckett, who's been doing excellent work for a long time for UFOs Northwest. And then about the same time, my wife got an email from MUFON asking her if she wanted to come back. And I wrote back and said for her and said, "Are you really sure that this is appropriate?" And I was totally amazed because Dave McDonald called me on my cell phone and said, "We need to talk." And I found out that he was somebody that I could really relate to. He also has law enforcement in his background as well as aviation, and mostly I think he has a genuine love of UFOs and the whole process of investigating them, and I realized that we had more things in common than we had different. And I decided that I'm more than willing to meet anybody halfway or further, and I keep thinking, what's really important here? What's really important is that we all do as much as we can to get to the bottom of this mystery. And if we get all hung up on politics and who said what to who in the past, and all we're going to do is waste our energy and waste our precious time, and none of us have that much. So I just felt like I had to go forward. And so I asked Mr. McDonald if I could come back, and he said, absolutely, we'd welcome you back. So I made my application. My wife rejoined. I have some other people that are thinking very strongly about it. And in fairness to the lady, I actually made friends with Marie Malzahn, which anybody who knows my story with MUFON, she said something at the wrong place at the wrong time, and I'm afraid it was the straw that broke the camel's back at the time. But I think I'm a different person. I'm going forward in a more positive light, and basically my goal is to investigate cases for anybody. In other words, if they're serious about this and they want me to look into it, I'm serious about going after it.
Let's talk a little bit about June again, and basically not the mouth but the Wallen from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Why don't you go and tell the story again? You told a little bit of it last week.
Okay.
But tell us a little bit about her, what her name is and all of that.
Well, when I first met June, I knew her as June Caba, but I refer to her by her maiden name because what I've become so involved in is the story of her life. And it's kind of appropriate that we're doing this right now because, in fact, we're having a get-together at my house, about a dozen of us or so, this weekend to celebrate her birthday, which is June 19th, and that's about as close as we could get. But the way
From the casual meeting, you became a very good friend of hers.
Exactly. And I guess this is where I would say to anybody out there who's involved in public presentations, anybody who's an advocate for UFOs, you never know who you're going to meet. And I have been giving presentations publicly since 1993. Yes, it has been since 1993. And I've done them all over the Pacific Northwest, and of course I've been also fortunate enough to go across the United States and even to Paris. And all of these presentations, the ones that were most exciting to me, are all because in 1993 I gave a presentation at the library in Ocean Shores, Washington. There were probably 20, 30 people there. And when I was all done, this very stern-looking elderly woman came up to me and she said, "You're right. The government knows all about UFOs, and they're keeping it a secret." And I could just tell from the way she looked at me that this was a very serious, no-nonsense person. She was wanting to really, you know, tell it the way it is. And so I said, "Well, how do you know that?" And she said, "Because I worked there." And I asked her, I said, "Would you tell me more?" And she looked at me kind of strangely and said, "I can't. They'll come and arrest me." And I think there was a little bit of a double entendre there because I had revealed during my lecture, at that time I was a state section director for MUFON, but my regular job, I was detective sergeant for the Aberdeen Police Department. And I let that, you know, I of course made sure to say that I was not talking about UFOs officially, and none of my comments could be, you know, tied to my professional employment, but I did let people know. I didn't keep it a secret, and I think June was a little worried that maybe I would arrest her. So I started doing a little checking, and the lady who some 5 years later became my wife, Joanne, was the children's librarian, and she knew a lot of people in Ocean Shores, and she told me that June was the last person in the world that she thought would ever talk about UFOs, because this was like a dead serious, no-nonsense lady. She was very well known in the community. She led the drive for a new library. There were people in the area who had known mafia connections that she didn't like, who were involved in city government, and she would literally get up in the face of these people and tell them off. And you know, but nobody ever said anything about UFOs. So nothing really happened on this story until 1997. Now, as we all remember, 1997 was a really big year for UFOs because on March 13th, 1997, we had the Phoenix Lights, which, you know, bar none is one of the major UFO events of all time. I don't think there's, at least for me, there's not too much argument about that in terms of sheer number of witnesses, credibility of witnesses. I mean, it's got it all. It even has the government cover-up with the fake flare drop where they tried to they try to say, oh, no, they went out and dropped flares from airplanes and said, oh, no, that must have been what you saw. And, of course, those of us who have looked into the Phoenix lights at all know that that's extremely bogus. It's about as bogus as the weather balloon at Roswell. It rates in the same category. Well, of course, in 1997 was, I think these events are all connected together. So we have the huge event that affects the public consciousness. That year, if you think back, was also the 50th anniversary of the Roswell crash, which was scheduled for July. And there was going to be a massive gathering there. And as I recall, I believe that it was so well attended that they had to hire off-duty police officers from all over New Mexico to provide traffic control. So somebody shelled out a lot of money just to make that happen. So obviously the public is becoming more interested in UFOs. So what did the secret keepers do? They published that book. Oh, no, we just happened to get around to writing it. That one called Roswell Case Closed. And like such books do, like Annie Jacobson's book on Area 51, it gets all this fabulous press coverage. And that's always interesting to me, is that whenever something that is on the side of the secret keepers is publicized, we get all this great publicity from CNN and, you know, morning talk show coverage and everything else. So Roswell Case Closed comes out from the Air Force. And I actually want to thank the secret keepers and the Air Force because they made my meeting with June possible. They made her
really?
Yes. They made her so angry when she saw it on CNN that she called me up, and out of the blue, I had not heard from her for 4 years. She had my business card, and she calls me up, and without even saying hello, she goes, "It's a damn lie." And I said, "Well, good to hear from you." So she starts telling me, she said, "That's the same lie they used years ago. They're always blaming everything on balloons. We used to type that up and send it to people when they said they saw a UFO. And I said, "How come you're willing to talk to me now and you weren't willing to talk to me then?" And that's when she said, "I'm 72 years old. I've outlived two husbands. My cancer's in remission. What are they going to do, shoot me or put me in prison? I can do either one." And I, of course, was not slow on the uptake, and I said, "How soon can I be at your house?" So I started going out and having coffee with her late at night, and she was alone, and she was kind of a night owl, and I would go out to this remarkable home that was on the canal in Ocean Shores, and it turned out, even though she had a visual disability, she was a master carpenter and a gardener, and it was just a really interesting house because she had made friends with all the animals and birds in the area, and so you had all these creatures that were hanging out in her backyard constantly. And she brought out all of her papers, which I still have. And these papers proved that she worked at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base between 1942 and 1952, and then I eventually learned that she had a Q-level security clearance, and she started telling me basically how different it is between what they tell the public about UFOs and what they talk about in private. And it's in private means inside top secret laboratories, scientists and engineers, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Now, remember again, 1942 to 1952, this is a key period because it covers 47, which is Roswell, and we know that the Roswell wreckage, the biggest part of it was taken to Wright-Patterson and to an entity which eventually became known as the Foreign Technology Division. And interestingly enough, we have all these figures that are really important in UFO history. I mean, if you read the position paper on UFOs that was written by General Nathan Twining in 1949, 2 years after Roswell, he says point blank, the phenomena reported is something real and not visionary or fictitious. There are objects approximately the size of a disc of such appreciable size as to appear to be as large as man-made aircraft. That is not a UFO author writing that. That is a man who went on to become a four-star general of the Air Force. Now, this is why I get so insulted and annoyed by media coverage about UFOs and the whole thing that goes with it. Because some of the best witnesses that we have are the very people who work there. And that includes my friend June. So June tells me about crashes. She said that by the time she left in 52, the Air Force knew about at least three crashed UFOs that they had recovered. And she said, of course, one of them was Roswell. She wasn't sure about the other two locations. She had all of this anecdotal information, and I guess that's how I separate this out, because I admit I was June Crane's friend, and I still consider myself her friend. And yet at the same time, I was also an investigator, because I was trying to put together this massive amount of information. So the way I separate it out is, you take June Crane's life, the part that you can document, and the things that she told me about that were kind of nuts and bolts about where she worked and what she did. And if you accept all that, which is very easy to accept, then the next question is, do you believe the other things that she said? And those things are really remarkable.
Like what?
Okay, here's the best one. The best one is that she had a particular incident where an officer who was probably flirting with her came into her office, kind of sat on the edge of the desk, reached into his pocket, and pulled out a piece of what all of us UFO researchers would call the memory medal, which, of course, is the holy grail of, you know, UFO research. So everybody wants to get a piece of the memory medal. This was the medal that, you know, if you fold it up, it weighs nothing. And if you fold it up, it will return to its original shape with no wrinkles, etc. You can't cut it, you can't dent it, you can't burn it. This metal is almost indestructible, and yet at the same time, it's light as a feather. So this guy gives her the medal and says, here, June, you're a good worker. Why don't you tear that up? And she said she tried. She tried scissors. She tried everything. She said she couldn't do anything to it. So she looks at the guy and says, what is this? And he said, it's a piece of a spaceship. And she goes, oh, come on, what is it really? And he whispers, it's a piece of a spaceship. And about that time, somebody else walks into the room. She grabs the medal, he grabs the medal, sticks it into his pocket, and that's the last time she sees it. So that's one story. Then she has another story about a master sergeant, and I actually have a picture of his wedding. Unfortunately, this is the problem with interviewing somebody, you know, who is getting on in years, who's trying to remember events that occurred when they were very young. She was able to give me the first name of this Master Sergeant, but not the last name. So Master Sergeant Clarence is somebody that they knew and said that he showed up in basically their coffee room one morning, and he was looking very distraught. And they started talking, and he said, I just flew in, and I've got wreckage and bodies. And they, of course, when they heard about wreckage and bodies, they all thought that this was a military aircraft that had gone down somewhere. And this went on, and he finally said, no, you don't understand. They're not human. They look like children. And, of course, we hear about big heads. We hear about wrong-colored skin. And I asked her, where did they put them? And she said they put them in a place called the Aeromed Lab, which she said, I had no clearance to get in there. And she said, nobody I knew could get in there, but that's where they supposedly went. Now, interestingly enough, that same morning, right after they had this conversation with this master sergeant, they're all working, and here comes a courier from the commanding officer who had what she called a too-hot memo. Now, bear in mind, this is before the age of computers. There are no, you know, there's no sending out email, anything like that. Everything is done on typewriters. Everything is carbon copies, etc. Here comes the courier from the commanding officer with this memo that says some irresponsible person has been discussing UFOs and crashed wreckage and saying that there are bodies. You will cease and desist from this immediately, or you will be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. Now, I actually have a copy of the non-disclosure agreement that June signed in 1952 when she left the employment of the government. And there are a lot of other anecdotes that go with her story, including her mentioning a project to me that at the time she disclosed it to me, you could not get information on this anywhere. And then several years after she died, it became public. It was declassified, and this was Project Caucasian. This is an example of what she worked on. Project Caucasian was the engineering project to construct a parachute harness for a hydrogen bomb to be dropped out of the belly of a B-36 bomber. So, I mean, June knew all of this. She knew the names of the key engineers in the field of parachutes. She always referred to a man named Walter Kanaki that she knew. And I couldn't find much on Walter Kanaki in the beginning, but now if you look him up, it's K-N-A-C-K-E, you will find out that he's considered the master of the science of parachutes. Now you say, okay, well, that, how big of a deal is that? Well, it's a huge deal, because we're talking about the kind of parachutes that will drop combat payloads onto a battlefield. We're talking about the kind of parachutes that you use to slow down spacecraft that are being returned from space. I mean, that kind of engineering requires some serious know-how. Well, these are the people that June worked for. And in the modern day, we would call her an office manager, but back then a woman couldn't have a title like that. She was just the go-to person that everybody went to in the office for whatever they needed, and she would work on classified projects, and she also described in great detail how she was in charge of multiple safes. And every day, she had to log in and log out top secret files, and of course, you had to have the need to know and the right security clearance. So although she was only a civilian employee, she had a full bird colonel backing her up, and she got to say yay or nay. And she told me that, you know, sometimes it was kind of fun to tell a high-ranking officer that, no, you can't have that file.
So, I mean, I wish we had more time to continue with this. One question from the chat room, they were asking, but this memory medal, how come the UFOs had... Were they torn up? I mean, you know, you think of wreckage as being, you know, all over the place, but perhaps not. I don't know.
Well, this is the interesting question, and I was thinking about this. I heard a debate on this. You know, the question was, okay, if this metal is so indestructible, et cetera, how come it got blown all over the landscape in Roswell? Well, I guess if you have some sort of technology that's advanced enough to take you in and out of our atmosphere and or take you from one planet, star system, or dimension to another, it would stand to reason that your power source must be equally advanced and probably strange and powerful compared to technology that we have now. So presumably, if something were to go wrong with that power source, it might create a correspondingly more dangerous event. In other words, something that would destroy the craft, presumably.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so what I'm driving at here is something, some internal destructive force apparently destroyed this craft. And
have you written a book or anything?
Yes. I have a book that's available on Amazon if you want to get it electronically. It's called Tell My Story. June Crane, the Air Force, and UFOs. And if you email me and you want a hardcover, not a hardcover copy, but a paperback copy, I'd be happy to sell you one. And my email is really easy. It's uforeality@comcast.net. And I should just throw this in for anybody who wants to get a hold of me. My website is James Clarkson, UFO, jamesclarksonufo.com. So that's jamesclarksonufo.com. Just run all those three together.
Okay, thanks very much. We're running out of time. I appreciate it.
No problem.
The clock's got us.